Omnibus is a production of iHeartRadio.
Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 1431.LK0429, certificate number 34056. Wide skies.
Are you a skier, Ken? Grew up in the Northwest. You spent a lot of time in Korea and went to school in Utah. Seems like
all ski destinations. There was just a Winter Olympics in Korea.
That's right.
The Olympics were held at Yongpyeong, where my friends who skied would occasionally go on weekends to ski.
Yeah, it gets wintry there, doesn't it?
In the mountains?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's dry, cold wind coming down from Siberia. But it's like a 3 or 4 hour bus drive. That was enough to discourage me from learning to ski at a time in my life when I could have been a Bunny Hill beginner. Mm-hmm. And now I feel like I missed my chance.
And in Utah, you didn't, some of the best skiing in the world is in.
That's why it's on the license plates.
Park City.
It says right? The greatest snow on earth.
Yeah, it really is something.
And I would go up to Park City because the restaurants were nice, but that's why we had to leave the state. They found out we didn't ski.
They said, and hit the bricks.
A bunch of very nice mob came over with torches and casseroles.
Yes, super nice.
And took us to the state line. They took us to Winnemucca, Nevada, and let us go.
They gave you some Jello squares.
They brought a Jello salad where the top was a mix of Jello and Cool Whip, mm-hmm. and some delicious cheesy potatoes. And released us on the other side of the state line.
Is Winnemucca considered the border of Utah? Because it seems a little bit into the state of Nevada.
Oh, that's true. What am I thinking of? What's closer?
Halfway across.
Mesquite?
Nevada. Oh, Mesquite.
What's right across the border?
I'm not sure.
It's the place where all the Utahns go to play slots and blackjack,
right? It's just a pile of cow skeletons, right?
The state of Utah?
No.
That's one way to think about it. You mean the place where they go to gamble at the border?
Yeah. Old cow skeleton, Nevada.
Wendover,
Nevada.
That's what I'm thinking. I guess Winnemucca starts with a W.
It does.
So I got it confused.
Everything in northern Nevada starts with a W.
Wendover is just a few hours west of Salt Lake, so that's where a lot of the... it's the Reno of crappy gambling, but from the other side.
So you're willing to drive a couple hours from Salt Lake to gamble in crappy Nevada.
And have $3 steak and eggs.
But you won't drive 3 hours to learn to ski in Korea.
I just feel like I was a lazy teen and I wasn't, I learned to swim as an adult for the same reason. Like I was like.
Never got around to it.
Seems easier to just not. So as a result, I'm in my 20s scrambling to learn all these skills that I put off as a lazy kid.
You're not wrong that it's easier to not.
And when you're smaller, you're closer to the snow.
Sure.
It must be easier to learn to ski as a kid beyond the social pressures.
The best part of learning to ski as a kid is that you can crash over and over and it doesn't hurt. Because kids crash all the time and it doesn't hurt. I don't know how.
Their number one activity is just falling down.
Just falling down and not getting hurt.
Kids will play whole games based on falling down. We got yelled at by the recess lady for playing like pretend to get shot and die in a cool way by jumping off the bleachers onto the side of the hill. And the recess lady was like, you guys can't do that.
Yeah.
And of course, we're, you know, show us where in the rules we can't do that. And she said, I don't have to. I'm the recess lady.
I continued to make good sport of falling down in dramatic ways into my 20s.
But you do get to a point where suddenly you make little creaky noises getting out of a car.
Yeah, it starts to hurt.
And I'm still the dad who's like, you know, jumping down the last three steps and hopping up on the rockery or the railing when the kids do it. And I'm kind of at the limit of my, I can't be one of these old guys with a second family in my 60s because I will not be a fun dad.
I've definitely started to make sounds. I don't think they're necessary, but they're sounds that are reminiscent of my dad. Like, oof, oof.
It's the kind of sounds I used to make if I had to run a 5K, but right. Now I make them like lifting a laundry hamper.
Well, the Northwest is famous also for skiing and winter sports.
It doesn't have that powdery Utah snow necessarily.
No, the snow here is often what we call cement snow, which is, is it's sort of self-explanatory. Pacific Northwest cement.
Walk me through the difference. Like, I understand that I want powder as a skier.
Yeah.
But why is that?
So there's wet snow and dry snow is how they're described in skiing. And dry snow, like you get in Utah and Wyoming, is light, fluffy crystals. We've talked about snow crystals before here on Omnibus. Light, fluffy, the temperatures there are, you know, a little colder. The altitudes are a little higher. And the snow comes down as, I think the crystals are like big and allow a lot of air to form between, you know, like the crystals right. Come down and they create big air spaces within them. And I guess it's that they have longer to crystallize as they fall.
And how does that change the aesthetic or athletic experience of being a skier?
Well, light snow is just easier to move around. As you've suggested, skiing is difficult. It's a lot of exercise and it's proportionate to how much work it is to just move your heavy skis through heavy snow. And when snow is light, you have a tendency to float to the top of it as you ski.
You're actually going fast enough that you can, your whatever your conservation of momentum will keep you above the, if you stop, do you sink?
Yes, you do. But if you hit a big section of deep snow and it's light powder, the snow will just explode in a big glamorous puff of, you know, of like flying of snow.
Warren Miller excitement.
Yeah, it's very fun to ski that style of snow. Pacific Northwest snow is denser, it's wetter, it often, like it's a differential of only a couple of degrees before the snow turns to slush.
Do you get a layer of ice on top?
So icy skiing is typically thought of, we think of it as East Coast skiing, all that sort of Vermont and Maine and upper New York State skiing where, you know, those are windier and lower altitude mountains. And there are a lot more skiers, I guess, on a lot less surface. So the mountains are small, right? I mean, Sun Valley or some of the Western mountains, they just go forever.
Right. I mean, just compare any Western mountain to the Berkshires. Right. And you could fit every mountain in Vermont into the shadow of Mount Rainier.
And there are fewer people up there because it's the wide open mountain west. Whereas on the East Coast, like everybody from New York City is all going to, they're all going to Killington and just scraping every last inch of that already kind of windblown icy snow away. So if you're an East Coast skier, you're very accustomed to a kind of icy, chattering ski slope.
That's why it's called Killington. It's just a bloodbath.
Just kills
as
you,
all yeah. Those people just scramble onto the... Have you skied all these places, by the way? This seems like firsthand.
No, I grew up skiing. I learned to ski in Washington, and then I moved to Alaska as a kid. And was on the ski team there and was a ski racer.
Are there decent resorts up there?
Well, Alaska has...
I mean, you can cross-country ski anywhere, obviously.
You do it anywhere in town. You can cross-country ski right out of your house if you live in the majority of Anchorage. There aren't that many ski resorts. There's Mount Alyeska in outside of Anchorage in Girdwood, Alaska.
That sounds like somebody pronounced Alaska in a fancy way.
Yeah, Alyeska.
Oh, I live in Alyeska.
Alyeska.
Oh, well, I'm going to move to Washington.
Alyeska is a very popular name for a husky dog if you own a husky. I'm sure there are 10,000 husky dogs named Alyeska.
Oh, I had no idea.
And I'm almost certain there are children now named Alyeska, although I would not recommend it.
Is it like the thing where you name your kid Heaven spelled backwards?
Yeah, I mean, it's a beautiful sounding word, but it's a little precious to name a child.
And is it from the same root as wherever Alaska comes from?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Alaska.
It's just a different pronunciation.
Popularly means the great land. I'm not sure if that's a direct translation, but...
It sounds like the Russian version of Alaska, like Alyeska.
Alyeska.
We sell you Alyeska. It's like Ensign Chekhov is negotiating with President Lincoln's cabinet.
There's also a ski resort in Juneau where I have been fortunate enough to ski during a ski exchange.
I like how you have the celebrity thing of saying that you were fortunate enough to do the things you've done.
I was.
Like, I love when celebrities get interviewed and I was like, yeah, and then I was fortunate enough to be in a movie with Julianne Moore.
Yeah, I was fortunate enough to win the Olympics. The resort in Juneau is called Eagle Crest, and it's, you know, it's also a small mountain. But the thing about Alaskan mountains is we have all the latitude, not just the latitude to be great skiers, but we are at a higher latitude.
And what does that give you?
Well, what a higher latitude does is it lowers the tree line.
Oh.
So as you get down in lower latitudes, the trees just go up and up and up.
You've got to go all the way to the top of the mountain to find bare slopes.
Right. Whereas at Mount Alyeska, for instance, which is only 3,000 feet above sea level, the mountain starts at sea level. The ocean is right there, visible from everywhere on the hill.
This seems like a problem we could just solve with deforestation, something as a species we're very good at.
We are good, and if you're making a ski resort, deforesting the hill is a big part of making the resort. You chop down as many trees as you can.
Otherwise, people plow into them, and that's how Sonny Bono died.
That's right.
I just called him Sonny Bono. He did, like he's Sonny Bono. Like he's in U2 now.
He's really... Bono is so Sonny.
Who do you like, Sonny Bono or Sonny the Edge?
We lost a Kennedy to a ski accident.
Really? Skied into a tree?
Skied into a tree.
Like a lesser, like a spare one, right?
Yes, it was Michael Kennedy, one of Robert F. Kennedy's many children. The Kennedys...
by the way, I just looked it up. He was playing football while on skis.
Yeah, that's such a Kennedy move.
Do they? So no matter what they're doing, if you're a Kennedy, you have to be playing football at the same time.
That's why JFK Jr. died. He was playing football in that airplane in the fog.
Well, think about his dad playing football in that motorcade. What a terrible terrible place for a game.
This Kennedy-based humor is terrible.
It's in poor taste.
I remember when my mom and dad first heard my sister listening to the Dead Kennedys in her room. Oh. And they were like, what is that noise? And Susan said, the Dead Kennedys. And they were so offended. You know, my dad worked for JFK. Right. They were so offended. They couldn't believe it.
That's funny because we think of that as kind of an edgelordy kind of, oh, we're the Dead Kennedys. Yeah. But there actually was a generation that would not have taken that.
Oh, they were furious. But Mount Alyeska, being both at sea level and adjacent to the sea, we had fairly wet snow, just as we do here at Snoqualmie Pass or White Pass. So you learn to ski a different way. You don't just kind of fluff along. You have to work a little bit harder.
So is there more skill involved, or is it just more of a pull? It's more effort.
They're different skills. I think it's regarded as easier to ski in powder, but also it's a very different technique from skiing on groomed slopes, which is the term of art for long pistes that have been smoothed over by kind of mountain Zambonis.
They have machines?
Yeah, big cats that drag sort of ski slope shaping tractors behind them, either chains or rollers.
What about resorts that have to put up fake snow? Is that even worse than wet Northwest snow?
No, that came about sort of during my era of skiing, the realization that you could put big fans and spray water into them and create homemade ice crystals. So if you did it all night long, even if you hadn't gotten a lot of snow, you could build up a pack of snow.
I think at Sochi, they had to bring up truckloads because they were so afraid. You know, that was a very low latitude for a Winter Olympics, obviously. Black Sea is like a beach destination if you're Russian.
Well, and in my own life, it's a sort of dramatic example of, and there's, you know, I'm sure there are people that would strongly disagree, but when I was a kid, we just got a lot more snow and a lot more cold weather in Alaska. There were multiple times that I would be at Mount Alyeska and there would be significant avalanches that closed the road back to Anchorage. I would have to miss Monday, sometimes Tuesday at school because you just couldn't get back. They couldn't clear the avalanches. And now, a couple of years ago, there was some winter in Anchorage, but a couple of years ago, where the whole winter went by and the temperature never went below what would have formerly been a very normal threshold.
We had a 79 degree winter day in Seattle here not too long ago. Yeah. So if they're skiing in the future, I mean, if any of the futurelings actually do something analogous to sliding down a mountain, they are maybe generating their own slime out of glands near their anus.
Well, you know, there now are indoor ski resorts. I think the first one was built in a mall in Dubai.
Yeah, Dubai does have one.
And
I need to look at a picture because I'm having a hard time picturing.
It's pretty phenomenal.
It's a single slope. It's just a big kind of air hanger that's higher on one end.
It is, yeah. But in addition to the difficulty of skiing in different kinds of snow and the different techniques that are required to ski in powder or on ice or on nice groomed slopes, the techniques of skiing have evolved over the last 100 years since skiing first became sort of popular.
I assume the gear has too. I mean, it must have just been a guy on two sticks at some point.
It was originally a guy on two sticks. It didn't take long for the original kind of ski makers, who were in a lot of cases just carving their own skis.
Just old Finnish men with a lathe.
They realized two things, which was a ski performed better if it had a certain amount of side cut from tip to tail.
Tell me what that means. It gets narrower at the...
Yeah, so the front of the ski, the nose of the ski, is wider than the middle of the ski, the waist, and then...
And I need you to hop... Oh, it's wider than the waist.
Yeah, and it gets wider again at the tail. So the sides of the ski over the length of the ski, it kind of bows in as a result of being carved.
And maybe this is jumping ahead, but are most skis still like that? If I go to a ski store, some kind of ski emporium, the skis would in fact be wider...
At the tip and tail.
At the tip and tail.
Yeah, so this is in large part kind of what we're talking about today. The original skis, they had a side cut that was fairly gradual. And the other element of a ski is the camber of the ski, which is...
Is that the curve thing or...?
Well, it's if you set a ski down on a table, the tip and tail will touch the table and it's the middle flat. Will be bowed.
Yeah.
And what that allows you to do is when you step on the ski and put your weight on the ski, the camber kind of pushes the tip and tail flat, but what it does is those side cuts then create a kind of there's a radius then that is suggesting a turn, right? So your side cuts, if you lean one direction, that cut creates a natural curve in the side of the ski. If you were just on perfectly straight skis and you leaned, you would just continue to go straight on one edge.
Right.
But as you lean on a ski that has this side cut in it, and as the camber pushes down,
You're on a curve.
And this is the radius of your turn. And any ski that has side cuts into it then has a kind of built-in radius to the turns it naturally
exactly,
will make.
Exactly, right. Like if it's more of a cut, it's going to be a tighter
it's
turn.
It's going to be a tighter turn.
Okay.
And so ski building technology in its early days kind of started, there was a lot of experimentation about what would be the ideal kind of design of those early skis. And by the 1950s, ski design had sort of resolved itself to a certain general set of dimensions. And the side cut, which can be described as if you took a ski and set it on its side on a table. Mm-hmm. Again, the nose and the tail would touch, and in the middle there would be an arc
right. Where
the sides had been cut in. And generally, the highest point of that arc would be in the middle of the ski, and the sort of standard design was a 7 millimeter tall side cut.
It's not much of a cut at all.
Not much. The skis are hourglass-shaped, but when you sit and look at them, it isn't completely evident that hourglass shape exists.
I think it's possible that I have looked at skis many times, and if you had asked me, are these going to be narrower in the middle? I think I would have said, no, they're just parallel lines. Honestly, this is probably something that appeals to you a lot about skiing, is that there's all this gear you can fetishize with elements of both fashion and performance. But to a beginner like me, it's terrifying. It's off-putting, the fact that I would have to understand all this gear in order to, like, I kind of panic when I'm picking a bowling ball, you know, like, oh, do I want the pink one or the blue one? 14, I can't remember what I used last time. Like, the idea that I would have to understand the physics involved in ski gear, it's not going to happen.
Well, and as soon as you introduce the idea of racing into skiing and really any kind of competitive performance,
yeah,
even just two people at the top of a mountain saying, I'll race you to the bottom, different brands of skis and the different technologies they use to create stiffness, to create the introduction of metal edges at the bottom of a ski so that the metal would carve into ice or into the snow.
Most skis now have metal edges.
Almost all, any ski would have metal edges. Not cross-country skis, but downhill skis.
Yeah.
Those edges allow you to really dig in as you push down on that camber and you create that curve. The edge also will then hold your turn.
Do cross-country skis, by the way, have no side cut because you don't need to turn that way?
Cross-country skis have a lot less side cut. Huh. You turn them differently, and they're traditionally kind of straight, although they have a very, very tall camber because the spring of the camber is partly how
propels you.
Boing, 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 right. Now, cross-country ski design has changed a lot too. When I first learned to cross-country ski, we would actually apply sticky tar to the bottom of the skis with brushes. They would heat up a pot of tar on top of a fire, and before a race, you would go dip your brush in and brush tar on the bottom of your ski so that
just more traction.
More traction, and
so you can kind of push off with each step.
And then you would kind of force your ski to slide, but you had that. Because you would only paint the middle of the ski. So when you were...
You could push off with a non-sticky part.
Push down off the sticky part, and then as you went boing, you would slide forward on the tips and tails. But downhill skis, although there was a lot of competition between brands to develop new technologies to make their skis sort of competitive with one another, the general design sort of settled down in the 50s to be one where, you know, essentially you had about a 7 millimeter radius or a 7 millimeter side cut. And the skis were a little bit wider in the front, a little bit narrower in the back. You had a sort of, you know, like 90 millimeters width of the ski at the nose, 73 millimeters of width of the ski at the waist and 81 at the back, which gave you a turning radius when you really dug into your turn of about 48 meters, sort of radius of turn.
How wide are my feet? How many millimeters wide are my feet? If that's what a Jennings is.
Well, that's an interesting question, and it doesn't, I wouldn't know.
Are they considerably, they're considerably narrower than one of these skis at the narrow point, or are they... Is the side cut narrow enough that your skis are narrower than a foot?
Well, this is part of
the boot makes your foot wider, obviously.
The boot makes your foot wider, but if you look at ski boots, the whole way that you bind a ski boot to a ski, those designs of bindings have been changing throughout time too. And a ski boot, you'll notice, has the boot portion, the bulbous portion that's holding your foot, and it's sitting on top of a much narrower base.
Yeah.
And the height of that base can kind of get you up off of the ski in a way that, you know, the base of the boot is as narrow as the ski. You are literally measuring the width of your foot.
Right, I have now a ruler on my phone.
Let's see.
It looks like at the widest point, it's about...
How many smoots?
It's about 9 centimeters, which would be about...
What, 90 millimeters?
0.052 smoots.
0.052 smoots.
So, yeah, so the ski is not that different than the widest part of your foot.
Right, but the narrowest part of the ski is narrower than your foot. And that's why the...
Well, the narrower part of my foot is also...
Oh, what's the waist of your foot?
I have like maybe fat old Russian women feet because my arches are flat.
Yes.
It's not much less than 80 millimeters though.
So there were some limitations about how skis could be built. And one of those limitations is, yeah, the width of your foot, right? If your ski would be too narrow in the middle and you leaned over, your boot would drag.
Yeah.
But there were also, skis were built in sort of factory presses, or there was factory equipment that kind of limited the dimensions of how radical you could be in the dimensions of your foot. But within the skiing community, because skis were more or less standardized, improvements in racing and improvements in ski technique, the energy went into changing the way skiing was practiced rather than thinking of it in terms of radical changes in the way skis were built.
You mean like just technique things?
Right.
As opposed to what if skis look different?
So skis were made with different stiffnesses. They were made with minor variations in
what's the material, by the way? Like, did fiberglass skis start to replace wood at some point?
Yeah, fiberglass skis with different constituencies of material in the core. Metal was added. A groove was put down the center of the ski for additional
to sluice off sweat.
Yeah, right. And for, all these techniques for speed and agility. There are different waxes, a whole culture of hot wax that was meant to make your skis faster in different conditions. So waxes were color-coded, and you would choose different waxes depending on the temperature and conditions that day.
And do you feel like this stuff all worked, like these were meaningful things, or was there kind of lore and superstition around, this is my wax?
I mean, I would put wax on skis sometimes, and the skis would be super fast. Other times, you would put wax on, and the skis would feel super sticky, and then there would be long conversations on the ski lift about how you used the wrong wax that morning. I mean, there was a lot of voodoo associated with it. And there were people whose job was to prepare racers' skis for the slopes. And they would sit and put on hot wax, and then you'd...
It's like a pit crew.
Then you'd scrape it off. Yeah, I mean, it really was like a pit crew. But ski techniques change. And if you look at skiers, if you look at photographs of skiers in the 50s, in the 60s, in the 70s and 80s, you see real changes in the way that skiing is being practiced. People used to ski with their ankles very close together, with their weight back on their skis. And as time went on, you realized, oh, if I lean forward, if I put my weight and my energy forward on the ski, I'll be more agile in the turns. I'll have my weight focused, you know, in the direction I'm traveling rather than leaning back with my tips way up in the air.
You probably want to be aerodynamic too, right?
You want to get down, but not down so far that you don't have full flexibility in your knee and in your body.
Who is honking at us?
I don't know.
Why did we decide to do this show on a middle of an intersection this week?
I'm fairly irritated. Let me just go outside for a second.
John is actually going out to yell at a neighbor.
Well, I gave him the international, like, cool it sign.
Okay, John's back.
Hopefully they'll.
In the bunker. So what happened?
Well, it was just somebody parked out front. You're right, the weather has changed. It's starting to rain. Somebody at the house next door didn't want to get out of their car and go ring the doorbell. So they're out honking.
Is that like an Uber or something?
No, just some dum-dum. It's probably coming to take their teenage daughter on a date.
I thought it was like your fans.
Oh, yeah. They come up in front of my house and honk all the time. It's part of the culture of my fandom.
Well, it's because that song on your first record called Please Park in Front of My House and Honk at Me. Like nobody understood that you were kind of in character there.
Honk at me. Honk at me.
It's a metaphorical honk. Hey, but you were saying something about ski technique.
Yeah, ski technique. Well, so in 1964... a couple of skiers, Pepe Stiegler and Billy Kidd, won.
That sounds fake.
Won medals at the 64 Olympics on skis made by Kessler, and most skis were made in Austria, Germany, Switzerland. These are but Italy at the time, and like a lot of industries, it became very bound by tradition and by some assumptions made about how skis best performed. But these Olympians that won in 64, they were on a set of Kessler slalom skis, and those skis sort of established a kind of What had been an informal set of dimensions became a set of dimensions that were really regarded as industry standards. And skis continued to be made more or less according to this, essentially a 7 millimeter side cut and 64 millimeter waist. They continued to make these skis all the way into the 80s. And in fact, the skis that I raced on when I was a racer in the 70s and 80s were all built on this exact model. And you could take a pair of skis from 1969 and continue to ski them on the same hill, skis that were made in 84.
The Kessler Run.
How many parsecs? How many beard inch parsecs?
And so it's like one of these many things where we see this a lot, that something that appeared to be in a steady state suddenly with modernity just changed rapidly, and it seems like everything's accelerating now.
Well, so
what changed it?
During this period, what changed was ski technique. And by the time I was competitively racing in the 80s, people didn't, when they made a turn, the popular style was to take your inside ski, which is to say the ski that's uphill as you make your turn, and lift it completely off the snow.
So you're just on your lower ski.
You're just on your lower ski and on a single edge on that lower ski.
You're like a figure skater.
Right. And as you then shift your weight to make the turn in the opposite direction, you would put down your uphill ski, initiate a turn on its inside edge, and lift up your downhill ski, and now you're on track to make this turn according to the radius of your ski design.
Here's what I would do. Here's what I would do, John.
Yes.
I'd just go straight.
I know.
I feel like it would just be quicker. All these guys are turning, making curly cues and radii.
It's a
lot. And then
lot
they get
quicker
to the bottom, and I'm already there, and they're like, what'd you do? And I was like, oh, I just went straight down.
It's a lot quicker, except that mountains, which are made by God.
For skiers.
For skiers and for aminals, right? Mountains are also where eagles live and
big,
goats.
Big horn
and stuff.
Sheep.
They're made according to a design that is derived from fractals, which is to say that it is an unpredictable, I mean, predictable at a, if you zoom out far enough, but when you're actually on the surface.
If you go straight, you might go off a cliff, yeah, or
into a ravine, into another skier, into a tree if you're a Kennedy.
if you're a Kennedy running a slant pass on skis for some reason.
Running the option.
I keep thinking about how you would play football on skis, and I'm having a hard time.
Well, you'd have to be a sporty
When the quarterback drops back, he is going uphill.
I think it's a thing where you're skiing down the hill with a couple of your bohunk friends
just
and you're throwing
tossing
football.
It back and forth like it's water polo.
And then one of your friends dies. So what was changing was this new style. And this was exemplified by the Mayer brothers, who were twin brothers from Washington State.
Ooh,
who
local interest.
Who learned to ski up at Crystal Mountain, which is a very small and very isolated, weird little ski resort down between Packwood and Yakima, that their parents either owned or ran. And they were skiing on skis made by the K2 company, which is also a Washington ski manufacturer from Vashon Island.
Vashon Island is just a short ferry ride.
That's right.
From Seattle, but you suddenly feel like you're in the country when you get there, because you are. There's dairy pastures, hundreds of unvaccinated kids running around.
You go back 40 years in time when you cross over on that ferry.
Well, or whatever amount of time before the polio vaccine was invented. You catch measles on the ferry. All of Washington's retired governors live there.
But the K2 skis had, some of the innovations were the skis were longer and their tails were stiffer. And at somewhere along the line, the ski company Dynamic, and the word is just spelled dynamic.
But is it European?
It's French, so it's Dynamic. They moved the ski boot back. They moved the center of the ski boot back 6 inches.
Oh, it's not clear to me that you would want to be back on the ski. Why is that?
What moving the boot back did was, although you're not leaning back, you do have, as you dig into your turn, if the tail of the ski is stiffer, if it's manufactured so that it's stiffer, and you're further back on the ski, you're able to propel yourself off of the stiffness of the tail with more, you don't have as much weight of the ski behind you. You're kind of springing out. And this was, again, another development that wasn't visible, really. If you were just looking at a ski, you wouldn't say, like, why is that guy so far back on his ski? It was just enough of a variation that it gave, like, the skiers who were skiing Dynamiques at the time just fractions of a second of an edge. But within,
I'm also suspicious of sports where so much of the advantage is based on technology. And now that's become every sport. But when I was a kid, I remember thinking auto racing. Well, they're just driving a car. That's like the car should win the award, like not the Italian dude. Well,
and this is true.
It's probably a class argument too. Like you've also got to be able to afford the new fancy hotness and fibers and synthetics every 3 years when they change.
And growing up in a ski culture, it is a rich person sport. And kids and their parents that could afford new skis every year had the advantage of these sort of micro developments in technology where you really would sit on the lift and talk about one another's skis. And there were brands of skis that you patronized and brands that you didn't. But the claim was that every year some new minor technology, some stiffness or some lack thereof, had increased your performance.
That's good for them if they can talk you into buying new skis every season.
But within a typical ski race, the gap between the winner and the second and third place finishers is often a hundredth of a second.
So a tiny change really can.
And a tiny change in your ski style, in your strength, in your training, in your looking ahead, because picking a line down the mountain, picking a path through the course also started to change. It's no longer making big S turns through the gates, but you're trying to pick a path that gets you as close to the gate as you can in order to give you more setup for the subsequent
gate. That's my idea about trying to go straight. You're just stealing my idea.
That's exactly what people were trying to do, go straighter and faster, but still turn. You have to turn to get, because ski,
fine,
ski race course placers.
It's not like they don't put them all in a line, no. like croquet, where if all the wickets were in a line or whatever.
No, they make it hard. They make it hard to get through.
That's so mean.
It really is. It's cruel. I like it like a lot of sports.
It's the Swiss, German, Scandinavian background of the sport. They're severe.
But when you talk about material differences, right, there are restrictions on how your baseball bat can be manufactured. And
how people, high the pine tar can be.
Yeah, people would cork their bats with the idea that that would allow them to hit further home runs. You can't use aluminum bats in, what, the American League, the National League?
I think both major leagues. In college, you see them.
And you can use aluminum bats in softball.
It's why football is the sport of the developing world. Like,
it's just
all you need is something bouncy of that size. You know,
but
if it can hold air.
I'm sure the Fédération Internationale du Football has real requirements of how professional soccer balls are made.
Well, there all the money is probably to be made in shoes.
Imagine how much, I mean, think about golf clubs and golf drivers and the changing technology and the expense of having the new putter or whatever.
The illusion of changing technology, probably.
Well, and tennis too. Tennis rackets used to be wood rackets with pretty small heads, and then Prince came out with not the musician, but the company.
That would be crazy if Prince the musician came out with a line of tennis ones.
He was the one that revolutionized tennis.
I've been in my studio and I've discovered a funkier racket.
But you know, those giant headed rackets that Prince came out with, which originally were just for beginners, kind of like make it easier. And then people realized the sweet spot was all this much bigger and tennis became more fun.
Swimming is faster. A sport where, like, you know, the records are essentially meaningless now, because as soon as a new slicker swimsuit fiber comes out, all the records will be gone. You can, you know, you'll beat the record by 5 seconds if your suit is made out of Swift Lawn or whatever.
Right. Super crazy. But this is the era in skiing when you started to see those ski races where slalom skiers were suddenly hitting all the flags. And
right. That's what you see now. And that's okay, right?
Well, yeah, it's crucial to it. And I was there at the transition. Originally, those poles for a ski course were made out of bamboo wrapped in tape. And when people started cutting closer and closer to the gates where they were hitting the gates,
the first
innovation was that ski sweaters started to have padding in them, like almost like football garments, except they were wool sweaters.
Yeah.
And those 80s ski sweaters all have ribbed padding in the arms and shoulders. And then as time went on, people got closer and closer to the bamboo until they were just breaking bamboo poles. And the new innovation then was that they would make the ski gates out of plastic, and at the bottom there would be like a spring, like a springy spring.
So it's like a Weeble wild horse, but it doesn't fall down.
So you'd hit them and the thing would go ho-poing, and then it would come back up. Now, sometimes if you did it wrong or if you were unfortunate, the thing would whack down, hit the snow, and then come back up back and hit you right in the face.
I'll say it. I don't like this. I don't like it when they – it seems like it's – you know, I get why you would cut it as close as you can, but when I watch skiing on TV and all the flags are going down, I'm like – it's like they're hitting every one.
Yeah.
You know, it's it seems like in a pole vault or hurdles, you don't want the thing to fall down. The sport should be constructed such that the object stays erect and beautiful while they cut it close.
Well, so the gate, you know, you have to have a gate because you're looking pretty far ahead in a ski race to make sure that you're thinking in advance how you're going to be, you know, you're thinking three gates ahead.
Yeah.
And so you need a pole to indicate where it is you're headed. But when you're actually in the turn through a gate, you're not thinking about where you are. And ideally, your skis and boots are as close to the gate as they can be, at which point your body is leaned all the way over. You're physically way on the outside of the gate. It's just your ankles are knocking the gate down.
They should be virtual. They should be lasers or something.
Right. They should.
We can all agree.
They should be. They should be.
One thing you take out of this episode, it's that me, a person who knows nothing about skiing, thinks there should be more lasers.
Well, what they should be is killer lasers, so that if you mess up,
just slices off part of your leg, just
cuts your whole body in half. So that would change the sport of skiing.
I think skiing should be a blood sport.
But at this point, now we're talking about the mid-80s, where ski design has been more or less static with these minor innovations. A couple of things happened. One of them was the advent of snowboarding as a popular sport. Mm. And snowboards were not bound by any traditional manufacturing technique.
Or by any legal drug use.
snowboards were not, they were bound by no convention. And introducing snowboarders onto ski hills was very controversial.
Right. To this day. Right? There's tension?
Honestly, there is tension. And I just spent a week up at Whistler doing some skiing, and skiers and snowboarders approach the mountain so differently. Their relationship to the fall line, their relationship to the way you approach the landscape of going downhill is just so different that they are incompatible.
It must be like a deep-seated difference in the brain. It must be two personality types.
It is, because on skis, you're pointing your body, you're pointing the tips of your toes straight down. I mean, you're going in the direction that your toes are pointed. You're looking down and going down. On a snowboard, you're sideways on your mode of transportation. So there are plenty of times when you're in a turn where your toes are facing uphill, and then your toes are facing down, but you're moving sideways relative to where your toes are pointing. And so when you look at a certain slope, you see your path down that slope in your imagination. You just see it differently. Mm-hmm. As a skier, if I follow a group of snowboarders down the mountain, they take me down even a mountain I know really well, they take me down the mountain in a route I would never, it's just not a way I would go.
Do you like that? Do you like seeing the snowboarder's view of the hill?
It's a challenge. Yeah. It makes hills that I'm very familiar with seem new, because like, why would I ever choose this route? But these guys think of it as, I mean, my sister made a transition from skiing to snowboarding at a pretty young age. She preferred snowboarding for many years, and she became an excellent snowboarder, a competitive one, just before snowboarding became really professionalized, before it was in the Olympics, before there was even a culture of it, before Snowboard Magazine became a common thing, and in particular, before women in snowboarding were recognized as a competitive force. So Susan was an excellent snowboarder. She'd been an excellent skier, and yet she was just a little too early in the sport to have turned it into a career.
Could she have been an Olympian?
Yeah, she could have.
Oh, wow.
When she was a downhill skier, she was on the ski team at Alyeska,
right,
and was consistently a champion. And the girls who were her consistent competitors and were always coming in second and third and despised my sister because my sister was not rich or cool, those two girls went on to be on the U.S. ski team. So, and Susan was better than they
she
were.
Always
she was just better, way better than they. But she had made the tradition to snowboarding partly under the influence of marijuana.
Like that's when you get offered your first joint, somebody should tell you, you will be in the Olympics that's if right. you don't light this. You're choosing right now. Do you want to be in the Olympics or do you want to enjoy Adult Swim a little more?
That's right. And I think Susan looks back and wishes that she had. She said to me one time, I don't know what we were doing, but she said, I had this lightning bolt moment where I realized that I could have gone to the Olympics and that is a singular moment in a person's life, that I may have been put here to go to the Olympics and I didn't. I opted out of it for dumb reasons because I like The Cure. And
I'm skeptical of that whole thing. And here's why, because the Olympians are all super young.
Yeah.
They're all like 22 and they either won or lost on the biggest stage. But they still have 50 to 70 years to navigate. That can't be what defines them.
Well, they do, but one of the kids on our ski team from this era, Tommy Moe,
went. You grew up with Tommy Moe.
I do, and grew up skiing with him. Went to a Metallica concert and the original reunion tour of Lynyrd Skynyrd.
But luckily you didn't offer him any drugs. No. He would have turned into a snowboarder.
We were both totally on drugs, but he he went on to win a gold and a silver medal in the 94 Olympics and became the first American man to win two medals in skiing in the Olympics in the same year. So he became a real, we were all stunned by his victories and he came out of our ski program.
Even I, a person who knows nothing about skiing, has heard of him.
Yeah. And Susan was competitive and on the same ski team with him. And she was like the number one girl of her age group in her era. So there was she feels like there was a missed opportunity. No, she didn't. She got out and into snowboarding in her early to mid-teens. So, of course, a lot of things could happen or could have happened on her way to the Olympics. But let's not dwell on Susan.
Certainly not on counterfactual alternate universe Susan.
But in the late 80s, in addition to snowboarding kind of expanding people's minds about the construction of these snow conveyances, mm-hmm. there were also just kind of a couple of happy accidents in the course of trying to teach people how to ski and teach people how skiing works. The Olin Company made a sort of demonstration ski called the Albert, which was a ski to explain how turning worked.
Is it the equivalent of Prince's big tennis rackets for dummies?
It was. They made the side cut of the ski, they exaggerated it in order to show to beginners or to ski instructors, like, here's how it works. You push down, you lean, and the radius mm-hmm. makes you turn.
Because everything's amplified on a thing with a bigger radius.
Right. And when ski instructors saw it, they said, that's cool. Why don't you make some of those and we'll use them? We'll make these demonstrations kind of with these funny skis and it will help us. And at that same point in time, a Slovenian from Ljubljana.
A Slovenian?
Yeah, by the name of Jurij Franko. And I do not know how to pronounce the first name, J-U-R-I-J. But I'm going to say Jurij or Jurij. Yeah, Jurij.
Yeah, it's probably their Yuri, which is George.
Yeah, right? Yuri, right. Let's say that. Although the ending J, I'm not sure where to put it.
If Slovenian is the new international language of the future, we will hear about it.
But he was working, kind of experimenting for the Aland company. And he came up with a ski with the dimensions of 110 millimeters at the tip, which is considerably wider than what we'd been talking about before as the kind of standard shape. And 63 millimeters at the waist and 105 at the tail.
It's also narrower at the waist, it looks like, or not?
Yeah, it's narrower at the waist and wider at the tips.
Looks like a Q-tip.
And it was a radical notion. They put it into production after a couple of years of experimentation. People were very, very doubtful about it within the skiing community. Like, it seemed like a kind of what we would have called then a free dogger ski, which is to say not a serious ski.
And what's the reasoning? It's just, there's no way it's faster?
Or? Well, it was just, yeah, it would be less stable, we assumed, because a flatter, wider, longer ski at great speeds would sort of hold you to the ground.
Yeah, as a layperson, you try to imagine somebody skiing on water skis and you're like, no. Like, the wider it gets, the less whatever is fast and agile about skiing would go away.
Right. But it turned out when these skis kind of made it out of the initial sort of test phase, Elan released the ski. It was called the SCX or Side Cut X Experimental. In 1993, they blew people's minds. Suddenly, there was this brand new innovation that no one had thought of, which was make that radius tighter and make those tips fatter. And the skis were hard to make. A lot of the equipment, the industrial equipment that all these companies had invested in to make skis, you couldn't make 110-millimeter wide tip. Like, the 100 millimeters was as wide as the machines would go. But these skis turned medium skiers into good skiers.
What was it like when you first tried these wider skis? Do you have to relearn stuff, or is it just immediately, this is like skiing, but on steroids?
Well, unfortunately for me, by 1993, I had transitioned from being a skier and a person that was part of an outdoor world into a grunge denizen and club worker and dark clothes wearing downtown cigarette smoker.
Was your family supportive of your transition?
They were not. No, they were not into it at all.
They would not use your new pronouns.
But I did not have money and my parents cut me off and I was not part of the ski culture anymore. And so I heard rumblings, I heard echoes that ski design had changed, and I was extremely dubious. And even though I had no investment in it, it's not like I was up there skiing on them or watching people ski on them. But even in my completely outside world, I still had very strong opinions about skis because I'd grown up having very strong opinions. All the other ski companies recognized that this was a true innovation, and they all started working on designs of their own. And our own K2 company here from Vashon Island came out with a series of new skis that had side cuts, the K2 1 through 4.
Were those the ones that kind of broke it that everybody...
What happened was in 1996, a skier by the name of Bodie Miller, who was on the U.S. ski team...
Again, even I know Bodie Miller.
...went into the Olympics on a pair of K2 4s.
So let me ask you this question. Is there an air bud problem here? Like, what do the rules of skiing preclude any particular design of
ski?
No,
there wasn't a system that said you can't use titanium, you can't cork your bats, you can't use titanium.
So it really is just put something on your feet and get to the bottom of the mountain.
Right. And because it's difficult enough to do that, like, hey, if you've got an innovation here, like, go for it. It's not like in car racing where they put limitations on displacement.
Could you put rockets on the back of your skis?
You could not. I don't think you could use rockets.
Could you have a parachute with a Union Jack on it, like at the beginning of Spy Who Loved Me?
It would not help you go faster through a race course.
That's probably true.
But Bodie Miller, on his K2 4s, won... the Olympics and won.
He won the whole Olympics.
He did. He
at
won
the end. As you know, at the closing ceremonies, they pit all the gold medalists against each other in a big royal rumble to see who wins the Olympics.
That's right. They hand each of them a British flag parachute and a machete. No, Bodie Miller became the winningest skier in American ski history.
Real celebrity. Like, even if you were not a ski culture person, you would see him on, you know, Zima ads or whatever.
He was a big shot. And his ski dimensions were slightly less radical. His skis were built with 98 millimeter tips, 65 millimeter waists, and 87 millimeter tails. But that was the beginning of the side cut revolution. And it was represented in the following sort of explosion of sales. In 1995, 3% of the skis sold had this innovative side cut.
Okay.
In 1996, 1 year later, 50% of all skis were built this way.
And it's all Bodie Miller, right?
That's right. And by 1997, skinny skis, which is to say the skis that had been-
Used to be formerly regular skis.
Only skis that you could buy were being remaindered by the thousands. No one was buying.
Do you know the word retronym?
No.
It's when you actually have to change a word because the default thing it used to apply to is no longer the default, like having to say analog clock or acoustic guitar. Those used to be just clocks and guitars. So, yeah, like we now have a name for wide skis, right? We just call them skis?
Yeah, well, no. So then in the immediate aftermath of this incredible transition that made skiing easier, that made it more fun, that made made it possible for amateur skiers to learn the sport a lot faster, to be making kind of exciting and beautiful turns. These turns held better. There was less slipping, chattering, less out of controlness in skiing. Then all of a sudden, all bets were off in terms of ski design. And people were trying every possible thing you could. You know, skis that had incredible B-shaped designs. And then, increasingly, wide skis. Skis that technology never would have enabled us to build before, which were ideal for powder. The first wide skis actually were snowboards that they just cut in half and said, all right, this is now, we're going to put one on each of your feet. And
it's like a movie where the guy's riding on something and then some kind of buzzsaw cuts it in half and he's like, whoa,
I've just invented a new thing. And wide skis really got you up out of the snow, and it was very much like it changed what powder skiing was.
Are these even wider than the stuff we've talked about so far?
So wide skis will go like 150 millimeters at the tip, 126 millimeters at the waist.
So twice, like it's two old-timey skis put together.
They're crazy. And ski boot design changed in order to get your boot up higher so that the waist could be narrower on some of these turny skis. The wide skis actually changed the way ski resorts and skiing happen, because wide skis are not super good on icy slopes, certainly. And so people stopped going skiing all the time, and they sat and waited for powder days.
And if you're a resort in an area that doesn't have powder, did people just see all their business get lost?
I think resorts that routinely have powder now see that powder is a whole genre of skiing and people don't even bother the other way. Mm-hmm. If you're Mount Alyeska or a Killington where there's no powder, people are still going to go skiing. They're just going to use different skis.
It's not like you can drive to another option.
Right. What's now the final fallout is that increasingly orthopedic surgeons and orthopedists have discovered that if you're using skis that are wide, you know, wide-waisted skis, the additional torque that's put on your body when you go into these turns is like destroying people's knees. And what they realized as they changed the ski design was they needed to make the skis shorter. What were formerly 200 centimeter long skis were now being shrunk down to 180, 160 in order to reduce some of the pressure, some of the energy at these longer lengths. But now there's a kind of movement within the doctor, because a lot of doctors ski also. As I say, it's a rich people's game.
You can't play golf year round.
Right. So now there's a little bit of a backlash against the widest skis because they're screwing people up.
We made skiing super fun, but now it just shreds your body, which is true of, you know, pretty much a lot of things you can shred your body with are super fun.
Yeah, they are.
We turned skiing into a weaponized drug.
But skiing is forever changed. The deep side cuts, the different geometries of skis for different terrains and different conditions. There's no putting that genie back in the bottle. And the last time I went up to a mountain with my old skis, my old 1987 Volkel.
Why did you bring skis? Those? You must have new skis.
Because I loved them. I you know, those were great skis and I wanted to ski on them. I took them into the ski shop because I wanted to get, you know, the bindings adjusted. And they all stared at them. You know, the young kids had never seen them.
You're like a guy with a steam-powered automobile.
Yeah, they got the old guy from the back office to come out. And the old guy, you know, was 37 and looked at him and said, I remember the grown-ups wearing those in ye olden times. And they refused to work on them. The shop said, our insurance won't allow us to do any kind of maintenance on this. So, and I said, look, loan me your tools. I'll sign. And they I told them I'd sign a release, and they brought out a piece of paper and I wrote on it, I hereby absolve the staff of Snoqualmie Pass from any liability as they loan me their screwdrivers.
Please let me use your Mr. Burns skis. And that concludes Wide Skis, entry 1431.LK0429, certificate number 34056, in the Omnibus. Now, wouldn't it be great if there were this kind of sea change in terms of the internet? Like, suddenly the whole industry realized we've been using the internet wrong. It's making us very unhappy.
We need to change the dimensions of the internet.
What if the internet were 6 centimeters wider in one part and like 10 centimeters narrower in another part?
We can't just improve our technique anymore. It's not just a question of lifting up our inside internet.
We are on the wrong websites, period.
I think it has to be. I think the internet has to go away and a new internet takes its place.
We can't just adjust. We've been trying to adjust and it's just making us miserable. So we speak to you from a time when John and I were so naive, we still had Twitter accounts at John Roderick and at Ken Jennings. John had an Instagram account. We made sure that at Omnibus Project was represented on all the social media platforms, on the information superhighway.
Oh, that's right, in a series of tubes.
We would even read, what if the tubes were narrower?
Well, they would.
That's an Alaska reference.
They would that is. It is Ted Stevens, my uncle's former law partner.
I thought you were going to say my uncle's former lover. And I'm sure it was just a few milliseconds.
No.
But like in my brain, I had like a full world opening up.
I know. Wouldn't that have been a different reality? If we constricted the tubes of the internet, I guess the pressure would go up. There's an awful lot of pressure on there now.
What if just all the Pepe memes couldn't fit anymore? If you just squeezed the internet. I'll sign the waiver that says, I'll grab the tube and see what happens.
Bad Pepe memes can go, but there are some Pepe memes that predate Donald Trump that I feel like were pretty good memes.
What if we squeezed the internet down a little tighter so that only 3chan could fit?
Oh, you only 3chan.
You lost a full quarter of your chan. John and I were so blinkered that we even read emails that were sent to us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com.
What a bunch of dopes we were.
We couldn't stay away from The Futurelings, which was a Facebook page, discussion page revolving around the contents and doings of the Omnibus.
Ken likes to look at the Futurelings site and then read it aloud to me while I sit across from him not looking at
it. Is that the only way you ever get on the internet? Is to have somebody read it aloud to you? I love the idea of like kind of reading the internet to, you know, the blind or disabled. You know?
Yeah.
And then somebody said, check this out, Mom. Oh, and then there's a picture of somebody wiping out on a skateboard. Okay, I'm scrolling down.
You're like, oh, did you know that the Futurelings? I'm like, yeah, okay, well, you just go on. You just go right on ahead.
Are you saying you're not interested in the news I bring you?
I am super duper 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 interested.
They're going to be talking about skiing in a while. Yeah. Like we can change, like we just talk about stuff. And it changes the pixels on this page. They're all going to be skiing pixels in a matter of weeks. We had one offline way of interacting with people. This is the old narrow ski way. We would encourage people to send us physical missives and media and artifacts at our post office box, which was the Omnibus Project, P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155.
Can you imagine a time when people would send packages to their favorite podcasters? Futurelings, you must be fairly gobsmacked.
The podcasters of the future get holograms of care packages.
I bet they just get bitcoins pouring in.
Ka-ching, 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 ka-ching. Just like in Wendover.
Listeners, futurelings, sentient icebergs, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come, except as it pertains to destroying the internet and rebuilding it in a new image.
Yeah, what if it's a virtual cataclysm, like a digital cataclysm?
I support it as long as all of our material is not wiped from the cloud.
A virtual comet hits the Earth. Its cloud is made of internet destroying photons or tachyons or gravitons of some kind.
Right.
The internet's gone. Everything in the cloud is gone.
We need to measure it in barns.
But I have all my, you know, I have all the Pink Panther movies on DVD, so I'm good.
Ba-dum, 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 ba-dum.
If you do one more note, you have to pay the Henry Mancini estate $100,000. Don't do it. Don't do it.
If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.